Thanks for tuning in to the Hope Church podcast. We hope that you're blessed and encouraged to walk out the gospel as you listen to this message.
All right, well, good morning. Let's grab our Bibles or our phones and go to Isaiah chapter 6. All right, Isaiah chapter 6. What we're going to do today is just walk through the first eight verses in the chapter and look at what took place around the year 739 BC and how that's relevant to our life right now in 2020. Believe it or not, it's quite a bit relevant. Does an encounter with God change everything? I think it does. It should. Sometimes an encounter with God, however, only changes one or two things, and that's okay. So an encounter with God should change everything, but I think sometimes on our Christian journey, we wait for these magnanimous encounters with Jesus to change it all. And what I'm learning more and more at the ripe age of 42 is the kingdom explodes in my life, not just with those moments where everything changes, but also those moments where I'm willing to slow down and catch a fresh glimpse of God, and one or two things in my life changes. The kingdom advances through the suddenlies in the Bible, but the kingdom also advances through incremental change. And it is just as spiritual to choose the process of God in our daily lives as it is to just expect for everything to supernaturally be altered. And that's what I want to talk to you about today. Sometimes an encounter with God doesn't necessarily change what we do. Sometimes an encounter with God changes why we do it. And in Isaiah 6, verse 1, it says, "In the year that King Uzziah died," who is Uzziah? We'll get to that in a moment. "In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord. And he was sitting on a throne, high and lifted up, and the train of his robe filled the temple, and above it stood seraphim." Seraphim are one of the types of angels that we know of that exist in heaven. There's seraphim, cherubim, nephilim, and I'm sure quite a few other things that we don't have words for. "Above it stood seraphim. Each one had six wings. With two he covered his face, with two he covered his feet, and with two he flew. And one cried to another and said, 'Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory.'" Verse 4, "And the posts of the door were shaken by the voice of him who cried out, and the house was filled with smoke. And so I said, 'Woe is me. I am undone. I'm a man of unclean lips, and I dwell with the people of unclean lips, for my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts.' And then one of the seraphim flew to me, having in his hand a live coal, which he had taken with the tongs from the altar. And he touched my mouth with it and said, 'Behold, this has touched your lips. Your iniquity is taken away. Your sin is purged.' And I also heard the voice of the Lord saying, 'Whom shall I send, and who will go for us?' And then I said, 'Here am I. Send me.'" Does an encounter with God change everything? Yes, but also sometimes an encounter changes one or two things. So I was thinking yesterday about this, how in Genesis 27, we come across a guy named Jacob. Jacob, his dad is getting ready to step into eternity, and the Hebraic blessing carried a lot of weight. And so Jacob knows that the blessing is supposed to fall on his brother Esau. And so perhaps you're familiar with the story. If you aren't, it's in Genesis 27. Jacob sneaks in and has a conversation with his dad, and he lies to his dad. And he lies, but the blessing is given to him. And so in Genesis 27, out of deceit and betrayal, Jacob becomes the son of promise. But in Genesis 32, Jacob has another conversation with his dad, but not his earthly dad, his heavenly one. And he's at a place called the River Yabbok, and he's wrestling literally with the angel of the Lord. He's wrestling with God. And God asks him a question, the same question that his earthly father asked him in Genesis 27. "What is your name? Who are you?" And this time he didn't lie. He told the truth. He said, "I'm a deceiver. I'm Jacob." And in a moment, an encounter with God changes everything, yes, but it changes one thing as well. And what it changes is this, because Jacob comes to grips with who he really is. God introduces him to who he was intended to be all along. An encounter with God changes his identity. I think of Exodus 3 where Moses, at the age of 80, is walking around the desert and he meets God at a burning bush. And do you remember what happens? The Lord invites Moses to go back to Egypt, a place where everyone knew he was a murderer, so his reputation was tarnished. He had a lot of bitterness and offense because of the prejudice that existed in ancient Egypt. And the last place Moses wanted to go was to a place where people persecuted him because of his ethnicity. And yet God invites him to go back to the place of his greatest offense, where he will become a part of the solution. An encounter with God changed everything, yes, but also changed one thing. Moses was willing to go back to a place that created so much pain and heartache for him and partner with God. And in Isaiah 6 that we're going to look at today, Isaiah has this encounter with God, and it changes everything, but it also changes one thing. And what it changes for Isaiah, it does not change what the prophet does, it changes why the prophet does what he does. And I think there are times where we need to volunteer again to allow God to search our motives as to why we do what we do. I'm reminded of Joan Murray. I think we have a picture of her on the screens behind me. I remembered the story about 2 weeks ago when I was just jotting down thoughts for today. The reason why Joan comes to mind is because in September of 1999, what I'm about to share with you took place. So 1999 is kind of a unique year for us as a family. That's when I resigned my job. I used to work for Medicare, and I resigned my job, and Allie and I became youth pastors at a church plant. I remember the church plant met in a school cafeteria, and they said, "Hey, we'll pay you if we get some money." And Allie and I just knew the Lord had invited us into something special. Was it perfect and easy? No, sometimes it was challenging. But I remember Allie worked full time. She paid our bills. She carried the insurance. And from time to time, God revealed how faithful he was. I actually remember on the first Sunday we stood up, and that's when they made a decision. We'll take a step of faith. We're going to pay you. It's just precious. You know, sometimes God waits to see if we will say yes, and then everything works out. It's important to say yes before we know what the question is to the Lord. Well, anyway, it was in 1999. That's the year Allie and I transitioned into that phase of our life, and that's also when Joan Murray. Joan was a bank executive in North Carolina, and she was 47 years old. And this would be her 36th attempt of jumping out of an airplane. Has anybody in the room today ever skydived before? Let me see your hands. A few of you. Okay, you inspire me. I don't think I could do it. I still get nervous when I have to climb up an extension ladder, okay? And so, well, Joan Murray was courageous like some of you, and 36th time she was supposed to jump out of a plane at 14,500 feet and plummet to the earth at 80 miles an hour. Just side note, there's nothing rational or logical about that, is there? Let's jump out of a plane, and somewhere along the line, somebody took some nylon string and sewed together this thing called a parachute, and the only thing standing between you and eternity is a few seams. And people pay money to do this. Well, anyway, Joan was about ready to do this, and she jumped out of a plane. Remember, she's not a novice. She's very experienced, and she loved it. It was one of her favorite things to do. So she jumps out of a plane, 14,500 feet, 80 miles an hour, headed straight to the earth. And at the time you're supposed to pull the chute, she did what she was supposed to do. And so she pulled it, but nothing happened. Well, fortunately, there's a backup. So Joan did what you would do. She reached for the backup, and she pulled the string, and nothing happened. And so 700 feet above the earth, a parachute finally deployed. So remember, 14,500 feet headed straight to the earth at 80 miles an hour. And 700 feet to deploy a parachute really isn't enough time, is it? And so you can imagine what happened. Joan smacked into the earth with such force, it shattered the entire right side of her body. To put it into maybe a practical perspective, it knocked all of the fillings out of her teeth. Okay? And she lay there in and out of consciousness, in and out of life and death. And by the time the paramedics got to her, fortunately, they were able to administer to her life-saving health care, and they rushed her to the emergency room. And Joan underwent quite a few procedures. She was in a coma for 2 weeks. But something that struck the medical professionals wasn't just the fact that Joan survived such a tragic fall. It was what they found all over her body. What they found all over her body were 200 stings from fire ants. Now, if I were to ask you, and I asked earlier how many of you went skydiving, a few of you raised your hands. If I would have asked you how many of you voluntarily lay on top of a massive pile of fire ants, I have a feeling no hands would go up in the air. Have you ever been stung by fire ants? I have. I remember I was wandering around Latin America and something happened, got a bunch of them in my socks, and it's just highly uncomfortable. Okay? Well, here's Joan. She plummets to the earth and she's in and out of consciousness. And what the paramedics and physicians later on documented is this. The exact amount of electricity that came from the ant stings is the exact amount of electricity that was needed to keep her alive until the paramedics could arrive. Well, after 2 weeks of being in a coma, she came back and she began to undergo some physical therapy and a lot of other things. And she quickly regained her body weight back. And at 115 pounds, a few weeks later, she jumped out of an airplane, her 37th skydiving attempt, and she did just fine. When I think of Joan Murray, here's what comes to me. Sometimes circumstances we ardently choose to avoid become a point of reference for what we need. If I would have asked Joan that day, hey, would you like to go lay on top of a pile of fire ants? She would have said no. But laying on top of a massive mound of fire ants is exactly what she needed. Let me phrase it this way. Unimaginable challenges are not solved from the same reality that created them. Unimaginable challenges are not solved from the same reality that created them. And this is exactly what happens to Isaiah. It has nothing to do with fire ants. It has everything to do with God's holiness. And Isaiah has a fairly unexpected, unusual experience as well that almost took his life, or so he thought. And in the midst of something that was highly unexpected and in many ways very painful, Isaiah's entire life has changed, yes, but also one area of his life has profoundly changed as well. And that's what I want to talk to you about today. As we get to Isaiah, it's important to remember a couple things. Number one, Isaiah, the book, is not in chronological order. We know that because in chapter one, the prophecy deals with a king named King Ahaz. Well, King Ahaz comes after King Uzziah. So in chapter 1, the prophecy deals with King Ahaz. In chapter 6, it deals with King Uzziah, but King Uzziah reigns before Ahaz. So technically, the events of Isaiah start in chapter 6, and chapter 1 is just a preview of what's to come. When you come to Isaiah chapter 6, Isaiah the prophet is 25 years of age. He's 25. Now, Isaiah was very different than other prophets like Ezekiel. So, for example, Ezekiel the prophet found his home in the rural villages. Ezekiel really didn't have access to the king of the nation, but Isaiah was different. Isaiah's dad was the brother to the king. So that means Isaiah had direct access to the national leader. Isaiah was part of the elite. Isaiah was a person of privilege. Isaiah was educated. He had access to resource. And so Isaiah, in chapter 6, when it says King Uzziah died, really what Isaiah is saying is this: everything that gave me influence, status, and power has completely gone away. So who was Uzziah? Uzziah was a king. He was the king of Judah. Remember, there's a time in Israel's history where the overwhelming majority of tribes formed what is called the kingdom of Israel. And then you have the kingdom of Judah. And Uzziah was the king over Judah. Uzziah brought significant national reform. The economy thrived under him. The military thrived, and you can read about this in Chronicles and Kings. You can also read about it in a stack of history books if you really want to. But Uzziah transformed the military. The Bible tells us in many ways he invented new things, new weapons of warfare. So remember, at this time, if you are part of Israel or Judah, everyone around you hates you. They hate you because of your ethnicity. If you were a Hebrew, your skin color was a little bit different than anybody else's. Because of their ethnicity, because of what they believed, because of how they lived, they literally lived with the consistent burden that at any point an invading army may come in and conquer us. And it's not just because they want our gold. It's not just because they want the crops from our field. It's because they literally hate who we are simply because of our ethnicity. There are a lot of people today throughout the earth who know how that feels. Some of us don't have a clue. But there are a lot of people who do know how that feels. And depending upon where you are in the world will determine your level of experience. I know what it's like to get off of a plane and walk through a village, and because of the color of my skin, my life is threatened. This is exactly the reality that Uzziah inherits when he becomes the king over this nation. And Uzziah invests a lot of time into strengthening the military. That's one of the main reasons why. And because he strengthens the military, the economy flourishes. He rebuilds a seaport. And because he rebuilds a seaport, the seaport strengthens and bolsters trade. And before you know it, he conquers some of the surrounding kingdoms. And people who wanted to conquer Israel now are paying taxes, or maybe a better word would be tribute, to King Uzziah. Everybody loved this guy. This guy in many ways brought about national security, national stability, national reform. But the Bible tells us this, and you can read about it in 2 Chronicles 26, I believe. That's the reference. He walks into the temple of the Lord, and he attempts to burn incense. And immediately he is struck with leprosy. So what's the big deal about burning incense? Well, in the Old Testament, God had three primary offices of leadership. He had the prophet, the priest, and the king. And the priest and the king were not supposed to be the same person. Culture was ruled by three distinct leaders. You had the priest, someone who was responsible to minister to God. You had the prophet, someone who was responsible to, put it this way, maybe allow God's voice to echo throughout society. And then you had the king, somebody who had fiduciary responsibility with government and other things. So when Uzziah walks into the temple and he attempts to burn incense, it's not as if he just forgot or he made a mistake. He made a conscious decision to violate one of God's standards. And because of that, immediately he becomes leprous. And for the rest of his life, for over 10 years, by the way, he lives in isolation and seclusion, a man covered with leprosy. And in the year 739, approximately, that's when Uzziah dies. So this king who's responsible for economic, military, religious revival and stability, for 10 years, the nation has been falling apart. The nation is divided. The nation becomes increasingly unsafe. People are not happy with one another. And for over 10 years, people live in that sort of ambiguity. And finally, Uzziah dies. And the one king that Isaiah the prophet had access to, Isaiah could walk in and have a conversation with the king and everything could change. Isaiah could walk in and have a conversation with the king and perhaps something would be done in the favor of somebody else. But now everything shifts. And in the year that King Uzziah died, what does Isaiah experience? I saw the Lord. There is something about instability that serves as an invitation for us to do the only thing that is necessary in the end, which is to see the Lord. He says, in the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord. The reality of God changes everything. How many of you know the reality of God is probably the only thing that can change what you will ever face that seems insurmountable, impossible, dangerous, discouraging, depressing, whatever it may be. The reality of God changes everything. And as we will see later on in Isaiah 6, the reality of God changes Isaiah's understanding of God, and it also changes Isaiah's understanding of himself. Let me ask you this. Are you open to God redefining your understanding of him? You know, some of the greatest forms of idolatry come in our belief systems, where we get everything neat and tidy and we get the box. And how many of you know there is no box? But we get the box and we create the box and we just assume God has to fit in this box. And just by the time the box is created, God does something crazy like allow the king named Uzziah to die. And then everything is flipped upside down again. The reality of God changes everything. Isaiah's encounter with God reveals how ephemeral or inferior our life is apart from the reality of God. Remember, Isaiah is one of the elites. He has access to money, privilege. He has access to things that most of us could only dream of. And all of it seems as rubbish next to the reality of God. You know, it's interesting. Uzziah, the Bible tells us he became puffed up with pride because of his success. That's why he became spiritually lazy. You know, one of the benefits of the season we're in, and we're in more than one season. In America, we're in a season of significant division because of injustice. And God cares about justice. And in the world, we are in the midst of a season where there is so much ambiguity and uncertainty because of the pandemic. In the midst of all of this, I think those of us who walk with Jesus can accept this fact that apart from the reality of God, so many things are so inferior, aren't they? How many of you know there are a lot of Christians in America who, because they couldn't go to church and listen to a sermon, had to deal with the reality as to whether or not they know how to self-feed? Do I know how to open up my Bible and come into the presence of God and feed myself, right? It's an example of how inferior and ephemeral certain things can be apart from the reality of God. And he meets God, and what does he say? The train of God's robe fills the temple. What does that mean? Remember, at this time in history, here was the custom. At this time in history, when a king was defeated in war, what the conquering army did, and I've shared this with some of you before, what the conquering army did is they stripped the jewels off of the crown of the defeated king and sewed them on the train of their king's robe. And they usually stripped the defeated king, put him in shackles because it was almost always a male because of gender inequality back then. And they took the male king defeated naked through the streets and made fun of the king while the train of the victorious king filled the streets. And the train of the king's robe was filled with the jewels stripped from all of the crowns of the neighboring kings that were defeated. Are you with me? And he sees the Lord, and the train of his robe fills the temple. And in Hebrew, this is what it's literally translated as. The train of his robe keeps filling and 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 filling the temple. It's a present progressive. It never stops filling the temple. Isaiah sees the Lord and he is reminded of how victorious God is. In the midst of national instability, he is reminded that God is not unstable. This is a word for some of us. In the midst of national instability, Isaiah is reminded God is stable. God is my refuge and strength, a very present help in a time of trouble. Even though the earth is removed, I will not fear. That means it's possible for the ground underneath our feet to vanish, and we're at peace. Can you imagine Joan Murray jumping out of a plane? I guarantee she wasn't fully at peace at 700 feet. But the Bible says it's possible for the earth to be stripped out from underneath your feet and you will not fear. The reality of God changes everything. Isaiah is in awe of God, and evidently the angels are too. In verse 2, it says that the angels cry to one another, "Holy, holy, holy." You know, the angels are not crying out to God. The angels are crying out to one another. And what is the topic? Holiness and glory. Holiness and glory. The angels cry out to one another about God's holiness and glory. In 8th century Hebrew, when a word, when a writer or a communicator is wanting to communicate volume, the word is doubled. So, for example, when the Bible says in 2 Kings, "I saw something made out of purest gold." If I'm speaking 8th century Hebrew, I would say it is made out of gold. So when a word is doubled, it is trying to communicate the highest quality. Nowhere in the Bible is anything tripled, except when referring to God's holiness. To triple the same Hebrew word is to communicate, this is unimaginable. This is an unimaginable, unthinkable quality. Isaiah is not only in awe of God, the angels are too, and they are in awe of God's unimaginable holiness. And holiness is not just saying no to the bad things. Holiness is not just having no sin. Holiness also means indescribable beauty and brilliance. That's why the Bible says we worship God in the beauty of his holiness. God is so awesome and beautiful and brilliant. He is holy, holy, holy. And because they have a revelation of God's holiness, what's the next thing that happens? They say the whole earth is filled with God's weight. That's the word glory. It is filled with God's weight. It is referring to the fact that God is so heavy, when God comes, everything gets out of the way. Like dropping a pebble in water. You drop the pebble in water and it displaces the water. When God comes, everything that is temporary and inferior is displaced. That's why the doorposts are shaken. Because God comes and something that is created from human ingenuity that is not supposed to move, even then is moved when God comes. Everything that can be shaken will be shaken. That's a New Testament way of saying the doorposts were shaken. When God comes, everything that can be will be shaken. You know, it's interesting. As we look at what's going on, there are some people who talk about how, man, this pandemic really did not get out of control like they thought. And I hear a lot of people complain about it. I want to remind you, the church all over the world was praying about it. And it's very possible that one of the reasons why the pandemic didn't kill so many people isn't just because over 100 national presidents overreacted. Perhaps it's because God's people prayed. How many of you know that we allow the news to control our narrative? And what I love about this passage in Isaiah is he does not allow the news to control his narrative. Everything is falling apart. Uzziah's dead. And what's he talking about? He's listening to what the angels are talking about. God is holy, 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 and the whole earth is filled with his glory. And a fascination, a fixation on God's holiness and on God's glory changes things, so much so that in verse 5, the prophet says, "Woe is me." You know, when he sees the Lord high and lifted up, he doesn't say, "God, you're real. I knew it all along. I told my buddies." No, he says, "Woe." And he doesn't say, "Woe is the nation. Woe are all of these crazy people. Woe are all of the conservatives and liberals." He doesn't do that. He says, "Woe is me." You know, when humility is absent, God's presence usually is too. He says, "Woe is me." And why does he say, "Woe is me"? When a prophet pronounces a woe, a prophet is basically saying a curse. He says, "Woe is me, I'm cursed." Why? Because I'm a man of unclean lips. I need to hit pause. What do you mean you're a man of unclean lips? Because you are a prophet of God. And you have access to the king. And you are a spiritual advisor. And you've prophesied for years. And what you use to find spiritual significance, your mouth. What you use to find and derive meaning, your mouth. What you have that pays your bills, your mouth, you're telling me is unclean. It's another reminder of how ephemeral and inferior everything is apart from the reality of God. Isaiah had been a prophet for a while. And he finally meets God. That tells me it's possible to be in ministry and spiritual leadership and not meet God. He says, "Woe is me. I'm a man of unclean lips." And then he says, "And I dwell with the people of unclean lips." He accepts responsibility for the dysfunction and the pain in his country. He accepts responsibility for the pain that exists in his country. And rather than creating a subculture over here to hide in, he steps in and he owns the space. "I'm a man of unclean lips, and everybody else that I live with is too." He repents for his sins, and he also repents for the sins of his nation. And I want to remind you that no matter who you are, God is not impressed. And you know what's even more crazy? God still cherishes you. We need God's people, myself included, to accept responsibility for ourselves and also the pain that exists in our country. The pain that exists in our world. And it only comes when we have the reality of God in our lives. Verse 6, after Isaiah says, "Woe is me, I'm a man of unclean lips," he has this crazy experience. An angel takes a coal from the altar and flies to him and touches his lips. The very thing that he confesses becomes the point of restoration. You see that? And here, when the angel takes a coal and flies to lips, two things happen. There is a symbol and an invitation. A symbol, because here in this passage, I see Jesus. I see how there is no hope. We cannot impress God with our goodness and our holiness. It's just never enough. And apart from the mercy of God, we can never be restored and forgiven. And I see the gospel here, that God in his mercy takes something apart from ourselves, and because of that, we can be made whole again. That's what Jesus did on the cross. But I also see an invitation, because here God is speaking to Isaiah through a cultural phenomenon. At this time in history, not in Israel, but in the surrounding kingdoms, let me share with you a common legal practice. If I was accused of a crime, here's the way it went down. After being beaten and tortured a little bit, I was dragged in front of what would likely be a magistrate. I was dragged in front of a magistrate and in front of a court and a tribunal. Somebody took a little stone that had been heated to 900 degrees Fahrenheit. And the magistrate would whisper a prayer, something to the effect of, if you are guilty or if you are not guilty, let the gods be the judge. And they took the coal that was heated to 900 degrees Fahrenheit and placed it on your lips. And if your lips blistered, the gods deemed you guilty. How many of you know everybody was guilty, right? God is taking a cultural phenomenon from another religion and another language and another country that Isaiah would have been familiar with. And he's using an everyday occurrence to communicate a significant truth. And God still does this today. If you've ever held a newborn baby in your arms, and you pick up the baby and you have this moment where you realize, oh my word, this is how God cares for me. The baby can't feed herself. The baby can't change herself. The baby can't bathe herself. The baby is 100% dependent upon the care and nurture and love that the parent gives, or the foster parent, grandparent, whatever. And when you hold a baby in your arms, have you ever had that realization that this is the way God is with me? That apart from God, I can't even make it. God is using an everyday common occurrence to communicate a truth, and this is what's going on when the angel takes a coal. He's speaking in a language Isaiah understands. And God does that to us today. He speaks in a language we understand. If you've ever been to Africa, and you see the religious drawings, Jesus always has the skin color of an African. You come to the United States and you look at religious drawings, Jesus always has the skin color of a white person. I was about to say American, but America's got more than one skin color. But how many of you know Jesus wasn't white and Jesus wasn't black? Jesus was in the middle. He was a Middle Eastern man. But when you go to Africa and you look at the drawings, what are you seeing? You're seeing that God takes a cultural reality and God communicates truth in a language people understand. Just like here. And that's what God does with Isaiah. His lips are touched with a coal. And for a moment, everything is on pause. And I want to close with this. And in verse 8, you see, I see that there are always two realities going on. Check this out, verse 8. In the midst of Isaiah having this encounter with God and seeing an angel and seeing the throne and seeing an angel take a coal and touch his lips, all of this is going on. Isaiah says, woe is me, I'm going to die. God is holy, holy, holy. All of this is going on. In the midst of all that, God is having a conversation. Not with Isaiah. God is having a conversation with the heavenly host. This is what is going on with God. Verse 8. And I heard the voice of the Lord saying, whom shall I send? So God is having this conversation. Hey guys, we need to send somebody. We need to send somebody to do what Isaiah's been doing for years. We need to send somebody to the nation to do what Isaiah is paid to do. Whom shall I send? And then Isaiah volunteers to do what he had been doing all along. I'll go. Here am I, send me. Sometimes an encounter with God changes everything. But sometimes an encounter with God changes one or two things. And in Isaiah's case, it didn't change what he did. It changed why he did it. He volunteers again to be a prophet. But this time it's different. Why? Because he operates from a place of God's reality. And I would suggest one of the most profound, God-honoring things we can do during a time very similar to Isaiah, during a significant time of instability in our country, deep heartache, deep pain. In the midst of this, perhaps we don't need to do something different. Perhaps we just need to keep doing what we're doing, but change why we're doing it. So as we go to the grocery store this week, let's change why we go. Just be the nicest person in the store. As we're on a walk in the neighborhood, and you see a guy out there watering his grass, and you just know, you know what? He's probably dealing with the same stuff a lot of people are. And perhaps you just don't change what you do. You're still on a walk, but change why you do it. And you just stop and talk to him. Right? I think that's revival. When we don't necessarily change what we're doing, we change why we do it. It's because, Lord, I saw you high and lifted up in the midst of significant instability. Woe is me. I'll go. I want to ask two questions for those in the room and those watching. First question is this. How many of you would say, you know what? I've felt the instability that's going on. I really felt it. I've not only sensed it and seen it, but I feel it. And you would just say, you know what? Remember me in prayer, because I want to see the Lord high and lifted up. In the year that King Uzziah dies, I want to see the Lord. And if you've felt a lot of instability and you would just say, remember me in prayer, I'm going to ask you to slip your hand up real quick. Okay. Yeah. Those of you watching at home or listening, I'm going to ask a second question. And perhaps you would be willing to also say, Heath, remember me in prayer, as you would say, you know what? I want to volunteer again for what I'm doing. But this time I want why I'm doing it to change from a place of encountering God, where my understanding of God and my understanding of myself has changed because I've caught a glimpse of God. I want to live my life, and I want the why to change. And I believe that's everybody. I'm going to ask you to stand to your feet. I'll close in prayer, and then Tyler will lead us. I'm sorry, I went a few minutes over. So God, I pray first for those who are experiencing instability, who right now, their finances, their safety, because the atmosphere is so charged. I pray for those, God, who are deeply concerned and their situation seems beyond reach, beyond their control. It's almost as if King Uzziah has died. I pray that they will see the Lord high and lifted up, and that they will know that the train of your robe fills and fills and fills the space that they are in. That they are in the presence of the Mighty One and the Always Victorious One. I thank you that your train keeps coming. And I also pray for each and every one of us, God. We say yes again. As you're having a conversation in heaven right now, in the midst of significant national instability and global instability, you're asking, who will go? Who can I send? And our answer is yes, we will go. Lord, send us. I pray that in our neighborhoods and at work and at the pool and wherever we go, that we will be a sent one, and that what we do may not change, but why we do it does. And why we do it is because we've seen you. I thank you for your mercy. I thank you for your word today. And Holy Spirit, please continue to speak to us where I have fallen short. I pray that we will hear your voice. Lead us in the way of everlasting.